Is your family an Easter Bunny family?
Not really. We're too Christian for that kind of.
I love God too much to mess with the Easter Bunny. I don't think I ever had a bunny, but we did do egg hunts. But also, can we unpack why it's an Easter Bunny, but the bunny brings eggs?
They're all symbols of life, of new life.
I know, but.
But why? I don't know.
But like, why isn't it like the Easter duck or the Easter goose or something? I want to know. I do want to know where that came from.
I'm gonna look it up.
We must do some digging.
Why is it not
the Easter chicken?
In Christianity, Easter eggs represent Jesus' resurrection and his emergence from the tomb.
So we're actually doing tomb hunts. Because these are not eggs. No. They're tombs.
Little baby tombs.
How do we tell the kids that they're picking up tiny graves? That's what I'm saying. So I think we should start the Easter chicken.
I agree.
Welcome to TikTok Theology, a podcast that tackles the major trending topics on social media that concern the Christian faith. I'm Megan.
And I'm Steven. We know you can't form a theology in 3 minutes or less, but those videos can identify current issues. TikTok will give us the prompt, and then we'll do a deep dive. Thanks for joining us in this exploration.
Hello, friends. Welcome back.
Hello.
Today's episode has a 25-cent word in the title. It's the kitschification of truth.
Try to say that without cussing. That's going to be hard to do.
He said, that'll run you up a little bit there. So what you may be asking, we're going to unpack this big word for you. But when we're talking about why does Gen Z care? Is social media having this conversation, right? Kitschification, you might not be seeing that word on your TikTok feed, honestly.
Yeah.
But don't fret. It is there, just not in the way that you think. Mm-hmm. So we'll unpack the definition and stuff. But kind of what we're unpacking today is like the kind of art or information that we've seen from Christians where it's like an artist drawing white Jesus, mm-hmm. or some of the corny Christian like movies and stuff that everyone kind of clowns a little bit. The entire Left Behind series,
the whole thing,
like, which is kind of cornball and we all kind of laugh at it and stuff, you know, a little bit here and there, of which people have had conversations on social media of like, oh my goodness, the effects that these things have had on, you know, Christian kids and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that's where the conversation is had on TikTok and stuff. I've seen people clown
of kitsch,
all of it.
Yes.
Of kitsch and all of it. But it seems like this kind of art or media of some sort, when it presents these things that are not necessarily biblically truthful or accurate,
mm-hmm.
That it's not communicating the truth and it actually is spreading to some degree misinformation.
Yeah,
we might laugh at it as being corny and stuff, but it actually does tie in to some maybe harmful things like misinformation about Jesus or Christianity and stuff. So we're kind of going to get into that today and unpack the kitschification of it all.
Yeah. What happened is I read a really interesting book that I want to kind of express a little bit that actually used this term. It's also talking about misinformation, alternate facts, and how all of those things work together with kitsch. And so it seems odd, but I think it's really interesting. This idea of misrepresentations or misinformation is ongoing, and it's hard for us to even figure out how to deal with it, right?
Especially with like AI and stuff.
With AI, everything, like there's so much going, like we have so many narratives going on,
yeah.
and we don't even know what's true or not true anymore.
Right.
And it's so tough. So what this is, and from me and my artist brain, like I'm like, ooh, I love this the way they're talking about here.
Yeah.
So let's talk about kitsch.
Woo!
So first, let's define what kitsch is and then how this might relate to truth and stuff. So the term kitsch is an old term that artists have used for a long time. It goes all the way back to the art markets of Munich in Germany between the 1860s and the 1870s. And it was talking about works that were like considered cheap, mass produced, you know, like little trinket type things.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like we'll talk about like the bobblehead Jesus dolls.
Mm-hmm.
You'll talk about like the little, you know, baby angel ceramic thingies, you know, those kind of things. Sometimes the little manger scenes that are little cutesy things, you know?
Oh yeah. The nativity scenes everywhere.
So those are all your little,
all your shepherds and your wise men, but the wise men weren't, you know, all that.
Yeah. All that. That's where it kind of comes from. It's supposed to be like an unsophisticated taste, you know, like they have popular appeal. Thomas Kincaid paintings are like the king of kitsch. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
some of y'all might get offended by this, but some people might call it Bob Ross. Kitsch.
Scandal.
Sorry, guys. Sorry,
guys. Said sorry to the listeners who love Bob Ross. That was not a happy accident.
Which is all of us.
That was not a happy accident.
Yeah. You gotta love Bob Ross, but you gotta love him, you know, even though.
And in spite of.
And in spite of. So the etymology of the word kitsch is probably from the German verb verkitschen, which means to knock off or to cheapen.
Put his German to use.
Yes.
Put his half German to use right now.
Yeah. Ich bin eine Deutsche.
Get him.
All right. So over time, the meaning of the term began to expand beyond just art, and it kind of talked about anything that was excessively sentimental, you know, gaudy, like it's provoking your emotions, yeah. Even though it's like cheap or not like real deep or whatever.
Yeah.
So
I feel like when you walk into like a house and they have like live, laugh, love all over
that,
the place, and
like a Hallmark movie, like, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
We're like, I love me a little yeah. Hallmark movie.
Yeah.
So but it's like the same thing every single time.
Yeah.
It's
kind of cheapy. They're falling in love, yeah, and it's raining. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Stuff like
it's
that.
Snowing, all that.
Yeah. All that.
Perfect.
Anything that seems to be merely there to entertain rather than to provoke thought.
Right.
You know what I mean?
No, for sure.
So kitsch has produced pleasure. People like it. But the idea here is that this pleasure is like an empty or imitative pleasure. Like, mm-hmm, it's like a counterfeit emotion that it's producing.
Sure.
It's like having lustful thoughts instead of like a romantic love for someone.
Right. Or like being on social media, which everyone, mm-hmm, talks about, you know, like you can have your online relationships, but it's not quite the same as having like, right, in-person, face-to-face relationships.
Exactly. So the way this comment came about, there's this philosopher named Thomas Kolka who identified two factors. So this is back in the day, 1800s and stuff. He said that there was a waning of the aristocracy, so like the rich folks, mm-hmm, in the West, and it facilitated the growth of a middle class. And so as the middle class is growing, leisure and consumption from them. So they're buying things now.
Right.
They're not really affording, you know, the most expensive art or whatever, but they still have the similar taste, so they're getting like knockoff versions of whatever,
yeah,
that art is, you
for
know,
sure,
that kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then also there was some movements in art, like the Romantic movement emphasized drama, emotion, and sentimentality, which I think fostered a widespread appetite for kitsch. So it's not
like
that, like
me and my Hallmark movies every Christmas.
Yeah, that's true.
They created it, and the appetite grows the more I watch
it. Then you want it, and so you get it however you can, and it's going to be with those movies.
No,
right?
For sure.
So that's kind of like the historical sense of what kitsch is.
Yeah.
And then for a long time, the application of the term kitsch, though, it started becoming to disparage certain artworks, and it seemed to evoke it like a classist thing, like the rich,
like it's
people
giving poor kind of vibes.
Yeah. Mm. Like they would point up their nose and be like, oh, that's kitsch, blah blah blah, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
That kind of stuff. And so that seemed really unfair, and so we had a really interesting kind of response to kitsch in art, and that's with pop art. So pop art, super famous, you got your Andy Warhol. You,
yes,
know what I mean?
Yes.
Like him, Marilyn Monroe pictures and,
oh, yeah, yeah,
the Elvis,
the
pictures,
soup,
the soup cans,
yeah,
you know, the Brillo boxes, sculpture. Like he did all that kind of stuff. He's your famous one, Roy Lichtenstein, Klaus Oldenburg. There's,
oh,
a,
yeah,
few of these famous, really, really famous guys. And what they did in the 60s is they wanted to push back against conventional fine art by engaging themes from popular culture, celebrity, advertising, mass production.
Mm-hmm.
See, what happened was right before pop art, there was abstract expressionism was all the rage. And so you had guys like, do you remember Jackson Pollock who used to like,
yes,
drip paintings and stuff?
Dripping
so,
on stuff, yeah.
Which is interesting, but like, how do you even like normal folks go into a museum,
yeah,
see a giant painting, mm-hmm, of just drip stuff, and their response is what?
Cool.
My 5-year-old could do that.
Yeah.
That's what they say, right?
100%.
But why are they appreciating art? Well, what the abstract expressionists were trying to do, they were like, hey, we really want to emphasize action, and we want to take out away the mediation and just actually express the action itself. So by dripping it, you saw his actual movements and you saw a record of his movements,
yeah,
as they were in there, and which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
He was basically the only one who could do it without being derivative. And so then when he did do it, you know, the art world is like, that's great. But then the real question is, most folks are like, bro, this doesn't make sense to me. It's like I have to take an art history class to even understand why your piece
why
is important.
Why this matters,
yeah. And so what the pop artists were doing is like, why don't you give the people what they want?
Yeah.
If their taste is to you unsophisticated because of whatever levels of education, who cares? Like they
give the people what they want.
Right. And so if they want to focus on celebrities or ordinary objects or,
yeah,
whatever, like show it to them.
If you buy a Campbell's soup every time you go to the store,
maybe you want to see
a painting of a Campbell's soup can.
Yeah.
And well, and they were right.
And they love Marilyn Monroe, right? Like why don't we,
yeah,
like that's one of the most famous things ever.
Yeah.
He also reproduced the Last Supper thing. He did a lot of stuff. And so basically he's doing like this this intentional kitsch or what would be kitsch, but in doing it, weirdly, it's no longer kitsch. It's like by calling it kitsch, it's no longer kitsch. Like you're aware of it. You're aware of what you're doing, mm-hmm. and you're just saying, "Hey, you've actually made art just for the elites, and we want to democratize art. We want to make it for everybody.
Made it for everybody."
And so that's what they did. They universalized its access, and with that, you have like, if anything can become art, anything will become art. And this is kind of our mm-hmm. our era that we're in now. So now you can paint, draw, you can make sculptures, you can do found art, you can do whatever. We're in a very pluralistic art world.
Yeah.
And pop art was a big major movement of that.
Oh, for sure.
So kitsch is kind of this major thing that was derided for a long time. Then it was embraced, and it was embraced because it gave access to people
right.
to explore art and whatever.
Right. So how does all this relate to
truth? That's the question.
You may ask.
Yes.
We love a good art history lesson.
So, which is good, you know.
Yeah, but, stay okay. educated team. But... Yeah. Yeah. How do we relate? How are we bridging this gap?
Right. So there's this philosopher and I'm a big fan. I'm reading his book and I'm like, dang, he's making some good points.
Like, oh, I love that.
and it's been, you know, it's been a while since I've read a book.
I mean, like, nice.
Where it's like every page, point. I'm like, dang, he got that. That's interesting. Like, man. Yeah. And this is one of them. Mm-hmm. So the book is called The New Aesthetics of Deculturation. And it's by Thorsten Botts-Bornstein. He argues that kitsch exists as a response to our neoliberal deculturization that's globally present today. This is what it means.
In layman's terms.
Neoliberal means, so we've talked about like the classical liberal, but it's really more on economic terms. It basically means that like the laissez-faire economics, capitalism, not regulating things and letting the market compete and mm-hmm. consumption patterns and stuff like that decide what gets bought and what gets valued and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He thinks that we are actually in a decultured place. So he thinks like, okay, humans need truths to believe in. Like we need something that's true to us or whatever. And so like, obviously for us, we're talking about Christianity.
Correct.
But like he'll say, cause he's just like, I think just a broad philosopher.
Yeah.
He'll say like humans grasp onto some truth to them or whatever.
Yeah. Something that at least is a point of uh-huh. which they live their life, that they know
beyond
this
themselves.
Is, yes. Yeah. Correct.
Right. And so he said historically cultures were the vehicles that transmitted these ideas, these truths. Now cultures is basically collective ways of living that's shaped by languages, traditions, religions,
yeah.
artistic expressions, our histories, all that kind of stuff. That's our culture.
Yeah.
And he says like that is like our culture is a thing that didn't, I guess, define truth, but transmitted truth. Mm-hmm. Like we came to understand truth
through
our lens cultural of culture, our yeah. cultural lens. And so he says in today's global neoliberal context, this like capitalist kind of like way mm-hmm. of thinking, truth is, and this is a quote from him, truth is increasingly produced instantaneously without cultural mediation.
Yeah.
So what this means is that people, and you can think about social media, it totally does this.
Absolutely.
He hits that social media pretty hard in a minute. I'll talk about that, but like, it's so quickly done that you don't have like your religion or your language or your tradition or your history or anything like negotiating it. It's not yeah. like, it's just out there and then exists.
Yeah.
And it's not like
nothing's being sifted through.
Nothing's being screened
Everything
out.
Everything just agrees.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so this is actually a really major point that he makes. Societies are, he's saying, decultured as traditional modes of meaning making are then hollowed out and filled with productions of rootless values that reflect our own preferences.
Yeah, I think I've heard people even have conversations about like we're in an internet culture.
Yeah.
Like where it's very, because we're all so interconnected, even like nationally, internationally, like so many people, like we're all kind of experiencing very similar things through mm-hmm. the internet. And so it's like an internet culture.
Yeah.
Because we're experiencing things that someone else over there in, I don't know, Eastern Europe or something is also experiencing because we both have TikTok.
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh.
But here's how he talks about against social media.
Right.
Because of our liberal society, we desire freedom above all else. We want to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And so what arises because of this is a decultured narcissistic outlook on life.
Yeah.
And so this is how he says it. Like social media, for example, it literally parrots back to you your own algorithm.
Correct. The Social Dilemma, that like that Netflix documentary thing.
Yeah, that was crazy.
That blew my mind.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, if you haven't seen that, that essentially does explain this exact thing.
It does.
Your algorithm will show you people who believe the same thing as you because that's what you're engaging with.
Or the exact opposite, so that way you can be enraged against it.
Correct. Like everything is to elicit some sort of emotion.
But either way, what it's doing, it's like whittling down and reducing your thoughts. Like you're in an echo chamber.
Yeah.
You hear the same people saying the same thing over and over, or you hear the opposite position said so brashly, so it engages you.
Yeah.
And so then you like become even more fossilized in whatever your view is.
Right.
So what you're doing is you're not getting a nuanced view on anything.
Yeah.
Your algorithms pair it back and reaffirm what you want to hear. Who then is your moral authority?
What you've decided you believe.
That's it. You're your own moral authority.
Yeah.
No one actually keeps you in check morally.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
And then they call it freedom of speech.
Who keeps you in check religiously? There's so much stinking biblical illiteracy.
Yeah.
It's not even funny.
Well, that's why we exist.
Yeah.
It's because of the amount of like what we were seeing on social media.
Trying to help it out, yeah.
Yeah, of like even what people are willing to just put on the internet without an ounce of study or background or anything. Like they find either one verse and they yank it out of context, or they, you know, guide it by emotion.
And
so
they make
it's like,
whole ologies out of it, like you said before.
Whole ologies out of one verse or a church hurt moment or a bad relationship or something.
They deconstruct because they don't understand what Jesus was saying. Because if they did, if they knew the shepherd's voice, they wouldn't be deconstructing.
Correct.
Not like that.
Not, in a different, in a healthier way, ways that we've talked about.
They would deconstruct
over,
the
way
bad
over,
stuff.
Yeah, that we've talked about in multiple different episodes across this podcast.
They wouldn't deconvert if they knew the shepherd's voice.
Right.
But yeah, so I mean, that's the kind of stuff that like, okay, you got a serious point. Who is your authority on truth?
Yeah.
And like just think about all the people you know that are like in echo chambers.
Yeah.
They don't trust anyone.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone I love dearly. And it's crazy that this happened. It's a family member. And she just got sucked into a lot of the conspiracy theory stuff. And I couldn't even tell her anything. And it's like, I don't even want to sound arrogant here, but I was like, listen, you do know I have a PhD in theology and philosophy.
Yeah.
Her response was just like you can't trust what they're saying in the education, you can't trust this and that and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, there's not even a good way to see what is supposed to be screened out.
Yeah.
Because the second chamber just kind of went over and over and over and over and over
again. Once you're in a vacuum, it's really hard to,
it's hard to get out.
Get out of it, yeah.
How many times have you heard Democrats and Republicans say to each other that they're brainwashed?
Oh yeah, it's pretty much the entire rhetoric.
They both say it to each other.
When you're arguing, yeah.
Yeah. And so like, look, if you are the only authority of the truth, and your only authority for moral, your only moral authority, then this is one, it's like a, it's a crazy relativism.
Yeah.
But two, social media compounds it and it goes through all that stuff. And so what he's saying is this shallow ethical values that we derive, it basically emerges as an uncritical fundamentalism. And if you think about it, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're only hearing your very limited and narrow view on morality and not a nuanced version of anything, then what you end up doing is you have a fundamentalism. You have like a very narrow view of life.
Right.
And that everything else is wrong or whatever.
And even worse, you're unwilling to hear it in any other way.
Right. Exactly.
Because now you've decided what you believe, and because you're your own moral authority, you won't hear other perspectives from anyone else.
Exactly. The empty, so that's what happens with ethics. It's, it becomes fundamentalism.
Yeah.
But the empty aesthetic values materialize as kitsch.
Right.
So kitsch and this, like kitschification of truth, they're totally related.
Yeah. They're homies even.
They're homies. So an easy reductionism of values occupy the same spaces that we used to have thick culturally formed senses of meaning.
Yeah.
Right. And so what they did do, they took that away and then they put in whatever.
Yeah.
And so like we've always sought meaningful responses to our complex questions of ultimacy. Like what, you know, what is the meaning of life? Why does this exist? Whatever. We have always thought that stuff.
We've always been existential. Yeah.
Yeah. We've always asked those questions. And religion has provided those complex, socially encumbered answers.
Yeah.
But now
it's why such a giant population of the world is religious.
Most of the world
most
is still religious.
Most of the world is vibrantly religious.
This decultured society is really only talking about the West. And I mean, it's global, so you'll find pockets of this everywhere, but this is mainly an issue in the West.
Yeah.
So in our, what are we saying? In our secular decultured society, what we have is these deep religious longings are answered by shallow authorities that don't know how to answer these questions. For example, the marketplace answers these questions for us. Mm-hmm. So we have a question about the meaning of life, and then what you are told to do is shop.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great artist, Barbara Kruger, that was talking about this stuff in the 80s, and she's the one who actually did the, do you know Supreme? The brand Supreme?
The brand, yeah. Oh.
So they stole her aesthetic style.
Oh, perfect.
So the red letters and the way she did it and the black and white picture, she was doing that in the 80s. She straight up stole it. And she has this one famous photo and it says, "I shop, therefore I am." That's what it says. Mm. And that's like exactly this right here. And she was doing that in the 80s. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, that's pretty metal to be thinking like that in the 80s.
Yeah. She's a very, like she'll speak her mind. She called out Supreme the other day and like really bad because they were suing someone for copying them.
And you're like, oh, you want to laugh a little bit here?
She called him out bad. And she's like, she's a little old white lady and she was using some...
She's like, excuse me while I tear you up.
She was using some vulgarities. It was hilarious.
Hey,
but
I mean, if someone stole my whole aesthetic to create a very popular clothing brand, I'd be pissed.
And she didn't, but she didn't say nothing for 20 years.
Which is kind
until they were ready to go.
Pot calling the kettle. Yep. You know what that's giving? The like parable. Mm-hmm. The parable where he's his debts got forgiven, the 10 million, but then he like strung someone up for 10 bucks.
Oh yeah.
That's what that's giving.
That's good.
Is I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, so when you do it, it's okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Oh, that's fine.
Look at that.
I'm like, oh, when parables play out in real life.
I like it.
Almost like Jesus meant to do that.
I like it. Did Barbara Kruger know she was quoting Jesus?
No, but.
Yeah.
Regardless. Oh,
so,
man.
Yeah. So, I mean, the marketplace can't determine our values aesthetically. I mean, I guess it can a little bit aesthetically, but like it can't determine, it definitely can't determine our moral and religious values, but it does. Mm. It does.
If you how much you have, what you wear.
That's it.
Yeah. So much of our identity and how we see ourselves is wrapped up in.
And if we don't allow a good culture to screen that nonsense out, then it's hollow and the market goes right in.
Which is why the point of it is like where they really, we need to be pointing back to the culture of the kingdom of God.
Yes. Kingdom of God is a real culture where Christ is king.
Yeah.
Now, this marketplace as the determiner of things, you know what that is? Worshiping mammon. Mm. That's an idol. Mm-hmm. And your idol is money.
Yeah. So the Bible don't play when it comes to serving two masters on that one.
It do not. It do not. All right. So when we talk about misinformation, he made another really interesting point. And I had not thought about this before. Mm-hmm. Alternate truths arise, he says, not necessarily just because of misinformation, but because of the kitschification of truth. Mm. And so what he's saying here is our current age of misinformation shouldn't be perceived just as like someone's like lying all the time, like blatant falsehoods.
Yeah.
Like that does happen, but that's not the majority of things.
No.
He says
if it was blatantly wrong, people wouldn't necessarily believe it, or it'd be harder to convince people.
But why are they convinced on blatant wrongs? Because
of a lot of little misinformations
that have
tweaked truths that led them to a conclusion.
They're a whole worldview that has shaped by misinformation and by alternate facts, by kitschification.
Right.
And so he says it should be understood what our era should be understood as an era where perspectives of truth are oversimplified and therefore misrepresented. Mm. So if you're saying like not the nuance, but a very simplified version of something, and then you're saying something that is blatantly wrong to reality, but fits the simplified narrative, then it fits there. And so this misinformation is like not a blatant lie. It's a logical thing of your reduced version of reality.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
I feel like this is how cults happen too.
It's exactly how cults happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so any kind of fundamentalism, which a cult generally is, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like it's like the most extreme case of a fundamentalism.
Yeah.
So if you think about with politics, a particular perspective is oversimplifies. You're either left or right. You're either communist or fascist.
Yeah.
Like that kind of junk. You're right. Oversimplified. And then you're pushed out to these camps. So you have to start like calling everyone who doesn't think like you a fascist or a communist, depending on what side you're at.
Yeah.
And you have to start seeing things not in this nuanced way, but in this kitschified way, a simplistic way of actual nonsense.
It fits into your view.
It fits into your view
of the world.
But doesn't actually relate to reality in its complexity, right?
Mm-hmm. I feel like this is why you need philosophers and artists still. Like, because I know sometimes some people are like, it doesn't matter. But it's like, this is such an interesting
way. It blew my mind.
Yeah, like, it's such an interesting way to view truth. And even though this isn't, he's not necessarily making statements that are directly saying like, and God said this, this, and this.
Right.
These kinds of thought processes actually really do lend to a biblical worldview and like the dangers of getting all kerfuffled and like by getting ourselves led away from a culture of the kingdom where we are letting our lives be oversimplified by the things that we're being fed.
Exactly.
And the thing, like, regardless by anybody. And they might not even seem quote unquote bad at first.
Yeah.
But you know, like they say, like the path to hell was paved with good intentions.
Yeah.
Like where it's like, oh, I had every intention to do this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. And it's like things can get real slippery if we're not rooted at the end of the day. Like everything we see needs to be sifted through.
Uh-huh.
The culture of the kingdom. So if we're in a space where we are deculturalizing in a lot of ways, how do we cling even deeper and more intentional to the culture of the kingdom?
That's really, really well said. So if you think about like, we're in an era of discernment. I've been thinking a lot about this. I think I'm going to try to work on the book.
Yeah.
So if we're in an era of discernment, what that means is we're following the Holy Spirit in the chaos of what's going on, in the complexity of what's going on.
Yeah.
What kitschification does, it reduces what's actually going on to make it unrealistic.
Yeah.
And that makes you think that you're following the kingdom.
Yeah.
But in fact, you're just following a reduced sense of things that's not necessarily true.
Right.
But what you should do is in the complexity of all things, you're following straight ahead.
Right.
The Holy Spirit.
Right.
Wherever the Spirit's leading.
I feel like the simplification thing, it just makes us feel better. Like it soothes anxieties. It makes us feel better where it's like, oh, if this is so simple, then all I have to do is A and B.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, in order to stay rooted, like we kind of do have to be willing to get uncomfortable and engage in some of the chaos of the world.
It's messy. The world
it is
messy.
And we have to be willing to stay engaged in it so that one, I think that helps us reach it. Like we have to kind of stay engaged in the chaos to make sure that like we are bringing Jesus into these messy spaces and not letting it us bow to how can we make this as simple for us as possible so that we don't have to get gross and uncomfortable with the way that the world is.
Yeah. That's so, this is why Christians, to bring it all back, look so dorky sometimes.
Yeah.
The reason why is because we're kitschified. Because we're like, we are not looking at the world as if it's the world.
Right.
We're looking at the world as if it's like it's like the like somebody's vision of reality. So like when you look at God's Not Dead, like I think this is the funniest scene ever. And this is in God's Not Dead, the first one. So you have like a philosopher who
okay. He said, I'm sorry, I'm gonna laugh.
Yeah, this is crazy. You have a philosophy professor who has this big class and he's like, this
you
is
have
so-
to tell people that you believe like, God is dead.
I need you to all sign that God is dead.
Like, what do you mean?
To stay in this class. And so he's put out on his sheet that if they didn't sign it, and one little Christian dude had the bravery, the courage to be like, I don't believe that. And so like, first of all, this is so stinking unrealistic.
I mean, yeah, I've never heard of anything like that.
I don't
even think that's allowed.
It's crazy.
Because that's straight up an infringement, whatever.
Yeah, but people will say, well, if it's a private college, blah, blah, or whatever. Like, look, the stories that you think are, some people are referencing, oh, well, this happened in this, blah, 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 blah. Go look at the actual facts of the story. It isn't even close to this, okay? I was actually close to one of them. Just a little sidebar. But I was working at Polk State College, and there was this young girl who was 16, she was dual enrolled, and she was taking a world religion class. And the world religions professor, now he wasn't saying things like it was a weird assignment, but he was basically saying, hey, you need to argue two alternative religious views from other perspectives. You need to argue their ideas as an assignment.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't do it. She couldn't do it. She was just like, I can't do this. They're evil and I can't do that.
Oh.
And so she ended up getting an F on the assignment, but she actually still got an A in the class.
Oh.
But this became a major news headline where this professor gave a student an F because she wouldn't denounce her faith. That's how it gets.
Oh,
yeah, exactly.
But he didn't.
No,
whatever.
That's not even what happened. Yeah. Now, the assignment, I think, is a little goofy. I think a 16-year-old is probably not ready to work through stuff like that. You know?
Yeah, it's a little young.
It's a little young.
Like, get your driver's license.
Yeah,
don't debate your...
And I think so there wasn't wisdom in the assignment writing, knowing that there's going to be dual-enrolled students in there.
Yeah.
But it's not what the media portrayed it to be.
Yeah, no one was asking anybody to denounce anything.
No, that didn't happen.
I've argued a lot of things in, like, persuasive, like... debate, essays I've written, persuasive
from
stuff,
other perspectives,
from other, all kinds of different perspectives.
It's a common assignment. It's a common assignment.
Yeah.
But like that's but my point is I worked at that school. I was an adjunct there. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, that junk doesn't happen. It's unrealistic in America. Like that's unrealistic. And so, but
yeah,
anyways,
in the US, for sure.
But in God's Not Dead, that happens. And so then the professor's like, oh yeah, well go teach the class. So he just lets a student teach his class for the next several weeks and the student teaches him apologetics, which is insane. That wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. Like you would straight up lose your job.
Someone would get reported.
Oh my gosh. And then,
if that happened in a class that I went to college in and then I was getting taught for 4 weeks by like
from a
student, I would be calling the academics office.
Oh, but he's got tenure. You can do it. No, people don't do that, man. Gosh, academic integrity. But then the craziest junk was the end, I think. So spoiler alert for people who haven't seen it. So,
which is like 10 years old. So yeah, go to the, like buy it on DVD.
It's on y'all right now. It's on y'all. But like he is running, like this one kid is running to a Newsboys concert. And he sees because everybody's just freaking, they're going to see the Newsboys, you know what I mean?
Of course.
Nothing against the Newsboys.
Nothing against the Newsboys.
But they're acting like they're Taylor Swift or something, right? Anyways, they're running there and the atheist professor is crossing the street and then gets hit by a car. And then the pastor, one of the pastors there was there and everybody's like freaking out. Oh my gosh, what's going on? And he's like, the pastor goes, hey, no, back up. And creates a circle. And like, and with the, you know, the professor just got hit and he's like bleeding out in the middle of the street.
Oh, the professor got hit.
Oh,
okay.
He's like, back up, everyone, back up. And then he kneels down. Do you want to accept Jesus as your own personal savior?
Shut your mouth.
No. You don't remember that?
I haven't seen the movie. Because
oh,
I have a really hard time watching stuff like that.
That's what happened.
It's so embarrassing.
And so I think the professor gets saved and then dies. And then
the professor dies?
Yeah. Oh,
no.
Yeah. I'm just thinking.
You want to accept God?
This is a perfect example. So like they did a good job of actually speaking apologetics in there.
Yeah.
Like the arguments they were making were fine.
Yeah.
But the situation
itself is not happening.
It's so incredibly unrealistic. That like any non-Christian is going to see that and they're going to be like, Christians think of themselves this way in this world?
Yeah.
That's insane.
It's also people, like I've seen comments made that were like, Christians, you're not oppressed. Like,
yeah. Like,
specifically in like the US, right? Because obviously Christians are oppressed in other areas.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
In the US, which is where we are, right? And so it's like, you are enforcing oppression on yourself. This doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
like, why are you training to argue with your professor that's never once going to ask you to do that?
Exactly. Oh, man.
Pumping your mental iron to try and dispute your tenured professor in a way that would never happen in real life.
It's crazy. I just looked it up just to verify. The professor gets hit by a car at the end of it and dies, but not before he becomes a Christian. All right. Anyways.
He's like, I watched a student speak in my front of my class for 4 weeks and now I want to love God.
Yeah. Because he got hit as people were rushing to see the Newsboys. It's like, bro, come on, man.
So like, see the news. Like, it's so unserious.
It's so crazy. It's like, how should I be offended as an artist for the bad artistry or as a Christian
for the bad demonstration and storyline
of the witness of
Jesus. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, oh my gosh. So like you have movies like Les Mis who explain grace in such a beautiful way.
Yeah.
Like the musical Les Mis.
Yeah.
Not meant to be Christian, but there's an explanation of grace.
Yeah.
Such a beautiful way. You have all these like artists that are awesome, like Terrence Malick, who's a Christian, who does these like really deep, rich things. Tim Hawkinson's a great Christian artist. You have bands like Switchfoot, you know what I mean? Like,
I love Switchfoot.
Yeah, there's
That's
a bunch
a vibe.
Of and even like Christians that are or bands and stuff that are unapologetically Christian, that like will just not be corny about it. Like Mav City, like if you see them talking to anyone, they're respect. They're just normal. They're not mad corny about it. It's like they understand the way the world actually works, and they understand the good news in the midst of this world.
Right.
So that's the question of like, does the gospel get messed up when we kitschify everything and portray the gospel to a world that doesn't really exist?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Our last question then is: does this give us a new perspective on misinformation? Is it mostly based on a reductionism of kitsch or are actual lies and false truths being presented?
Mm.
I think it's probably both.
Yeah.
But those false truths and lies kind of exist in kitschified realities.
Right.
You know what I mean? What do you think?
I would agree. I think it's easier to, I mean, this kitschification, the reductionism of it, when it's helpful or it's like, it feels like, oh yeah, I'll accept something that feels easy to accept.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that's general humans. Like,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're not like, some people are not, do not love super deep thinking. They do not like that. That's not mm-hmm. their ministry. And then there's other people who like, they get their degrees in philosophy because they love the deep thinking. Right?
Right.
And so, but I think a general medium of everyone would be like, yeah, I like to accept things that make sense
yeah.
and are simple and mm-hmm. I can understand it. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that's why it's important as believers to make sure that we're not so much being like, oh, I'll accept everything that is simple and easy
yeah.
to me. Because that's going to make me feel better. It's like, no.
The Bible is pretty complex.
The Bible is very complex.
And the world is too.
And the world is very complex. And simplicity can be a false comfort.
Yeah.
Because it makes us feel like we understand more than we do.
Uh-huh.
But I think we have to be willing to do that in all areas, like politically, yeah. academically, like be willing to engage with more than just the people who agree with what we agree with or the yeah. things that make sense to us. Like, I think that we need to be people who engage outside of just the kitsch of, oh, everything is really easy to understand when you present yeah. it to me in this manner.
This comes down to like the main point of even our podcast. You know, in my ethics class, some classes that I teach.
Yeah.
One of my main goals is for students to learn why the arguments of another side actually make sense.
Yeah.
Not that they should necessarily agree with them,
yeah.
but why they make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because once they even come to a point of understanding the other side, what happens is I see them being more gracious,
yeah.
being more empathetic,
yeah.
still saying, okay, I disagree on these points here,
yeah.
but I know where you're coming from. You're not actually crazy.
Yeah.
And that is a unkitchified way of looking at it.
Yeah.
That's actually,
it makes it a little more complicated and digs in a little deeper.
It
makes room for nuance.
But nuance and clarity within the nuance of yeah. like why you're holding what you're doing, but then also just a general sense of clarity.
Yeah.
It's like everybody in Jesus' day demonized lepers and prostitutes and mm-hmm. tax collectors.
Yeah.
But Jesus saw them.
Yeah.
He understood why they were where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And then show them a way out of it.
Yeah.
It's like he saw them where they were at.
Yep.
It's like the rest of his day kitschified everything.
Yeah. It's real simple to write people off.
To write them
it's
off.
It's actually quite hard and difficult
to engage
with people.
And that's exactly what Jesus did.
And it's what us as Christians are called to do.
And we're called to do. So I think, you know, how does this affect us doing ministry today? Take some time to explain things. Slow down. Be authentic. We know mm-hmm. how important authenticity is for Gen Z and for everybody.
Yeah.
Take time to actually love people and meet them where they're at. It
yeah.
doesn't mean, remember when Jesus met the woman at the well, he called her out, her whole everything.
She read the mail.
Yeah.
He read the mail.
Hey, you've been with five men and you've been doing all this. He said the whole nine yards. And she was like, oh my gosh, he knows me. But then he showed compassion. He showed yeah. grace. He mm-hmm. showed mercy.
Yeah.
But then what did he say at the end of this encounter and other encounters that he does? Go and sin no more.
Yeah.
So there's this speaking of truth, but only when he was in the mud with them.
Yeah.
When he was in the complexity of the situation with them,
yeah.
he was able to show them the light out of whatever that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's be nuanced. Let's not complicate things in order to complicate them.
Yeah.
But let's recognize the fact that some things are very complicated.
Yeah. It is a noble endeavor to engage in what is complicated about people and relationships
yeah.
and our faith. And look, bring truth to those things.
Our minds are complicated. Our mm-hmm. bodies are complicated. Mm-hmm. Our social relations are complicated. These things all have so many multifaceted aspects about them
yeah.
that have shaped us and malformed us in many ways
yeah.
when they're not, you know, in God and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but getting in the mud there, knowing this messiness and seeing what's going on,
mm-hmm.
that's when we can meet people and show them Christ.
Yep.
I love this conversation. I thought it was super interesting.
Yeah.
We'll put some good info for you guys in the show notes.
And now you can be empowered to use the word kitsch and kitschification in regular conversations
Boom.
With people.
Yeah.
You've learned.
Get ready to explain it for the next 12 minutes after
yeah,
you use
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly. But you will get to drop it in a conversation.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see you next time. This was brought to you by the School of Theology and Ministry
at Life Pacific University. See yeah. you next time.